Members, I call this meeting of the Property Taxes and Local Government Finance Committee to order. We'll begin with the approval of minutes. Representative Carlson moves the minutes of February 22nd, 2017. Any additions or corrections to the minutes as presented? Okay. Hearing none, all in favor of approving minutes as presented, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The minutes are approved. We're going to begin, actually, with, rather than the order we have on here, Representative Garofalo is not able to join us right now, but I understand Representative Mariani is here for his bill. Representative Mariani, welcome to the committee with House File 767. Representative Nelson moves that the committee entertain the House File 767 and then it be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members, and always glad to bail out my good friend, Representative Garofalo. So it works out in my favor as well. Mr. Chair, members, some of you who were here last year may recall that we had a hearing on this bill. We had a very good discussion on it, and I appreciate the willingness of the committee to look at it at that point and then to continue to look at this issue this year. The members, really, quite simply, right now under Minnesota law, in order for a homeowner to obtain a homestead tax credit and the benefits and responsibilities that go along with that, in addition to a number of other conditions, they're required to use a Social Security number and/or a ITIN number if the co-owner typically a spouse has a Social Security number. What this bill would do is allow a homeowner to use an ITIN number in order to apply for the homestead credit and designation, which involves the credit as well. ITIN number is a, many of you may be familiar with it, it's a tax processing number that's issued by the Internal Revenue Service. It's a 9-digit number that always begins with the number 9. They're issued regardless of immigration status because both resident and non-resident aliens may have a U.S. filing or reporting requirement under the Internal Revenue Code. That's a kind of a real nice way of saying if you're generating economic activity in our nation, you have a responsibility to pay the taxes on that. ITINs are used only for federal tax reporting purposes, and they're not intended to serve any other purpose. And again, they're issued to foreign nationals and others who have federal tax reporting or filing requirements but do not qualify for Social Security numbers, and there could be a whole host of reasons for that. Mr. Chair, I think it's fair to say that one of the major reasons why we require the use of a number of official federally designated numbers for us to properly track individuals that are applying for benefits and are to be held responsible, to meet Minnesota law. Without the use of a tracking designation, we would not be able to verify individuals meeting those responsibilities or, quite frankly, prevent fraud from individuals who would misuse accessing, in this case, homestead credits. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll stop. I do have a testifier from the Ramsey County Assessor's Office who can shed some more light and do a far better job than I can in answering some of the technical questions.
Thank you, Representative Mariani. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Baker. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning. I'm Stephen Baker. I'm the assessor for Ramsey County
And as Representative Mariani has said, you know, we currently have homesteaders that, properties that are homesteaded that are blended, where one owner is a Social Security number and one owner is an I-10. The current law prohibits us from granting homestead if there's only an I-10 owner in place. And that also then prevents that homeowner from being eligible for a property tax refund from the state of Minnesota. What I would say about the laws, I've not heard of any problems with moving to this, either from the Department of Revenue or from Minnesota assessors. We do currently report I-10s on our Social Security match file with the state, so we're used to keeping track of those. Our systems manage them. I understand that the state is still looking a little bit at the ECRV system and making sure that that system could handle it. But so far, the folks that we've talked to have been comfortable with having a homestead granted with only an I-10 number in place, if that was the policy decision that the legislature wanted to make. What I would say in Ramsey County is that, you know, we would support this because it's more clear to our taxpayers. Frankly, this feels like kind of a gotcha to some of the owners here. When they find out that they don't qualify, it's confusing to administer. And I think there has been some inconsistent administration around the state in the past. I don't know if anything is still that way today, but to have this be consistent, where if you are an owner and you're occupying the property, you're eligible for homestead, kind of makes some sense from a transparency and simplification standpoint.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Anyone else who would like to testify? Is Mr. Jimenez here? We have him on the list. Maybe not. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Members, any questions? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think particularly for those blended households and others, you know, this makes a lot of sense, and there are people who are in our community and paying taxes and deserve some benefits. I assume that they would have to sign the same paperwork that anyone else would, certifying that this is their only homestead, that they live there, that they meet all the other requirements.
Representative Mariani?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, that would be correct. This language only builds off of the current ability to use I-10 to be able to do that for a situation that's not abundant, necessarily abundant situation. All the other requirements would remain the same.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Ms. Schill, can you quickly, Representative Hertas has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mariani, I have always kind of felt that a house is a house is a house, regardless of who owns it. Would you support just collapsing the homestead and non-homestead categories into the same rate and just doing away with the homestead nonsense?
Representative Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Hertas, I suspect that's a pretty big discussion and debate in this legislature. My attempt is not to do a big, massive, reform of our tax code as much as it is to do something that's consistent with current practice and make sure that, you know, there's clarity involved and that there's transparency and that we do stick to the principle that everyone, if a homeowner meets all the other requirements, then that they be included, in our recognition of their homestead status. I look forward to the ongoing bigger debate, though.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Schill, can you quickly outline the difference between the fiscal note and the revenue note we have?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for this particular item, you have both a revenue estimate for House File 767, and then if you note on that revenue estimate up in the right-hand corner, under the box that says, is there a DOR administrative cost, that box is checked yes, and therefore that triggers an inquiry into what the administration of this would be. And so what I did for you, since processing a fiscal note that talks about administrative costs, I used the revenue estimate from last year's bill. And so that gives you an idea that there is a modest administrative cost associated with bringing this on board. And it's mostly employee time. I compared also last year's revenue estimate to this year's revenue estimate, and it turns out that there's a significant decrease in cost. So what does that mean on the administrative side? This is a ballpark administrative estimate. It's likely less than this, and that's basically what I wanted to let you know.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Members, any other questions? With that, thank you, Representative Mariani. Do you have any closing comments before we lay the bill over?
Mr. Chair, members, again, I appreciate the opportunity to vet this before you. I would look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and your members on any other questions the members may have. And then, obviously, as you work through, as a committee, what you need to work through in terms of meeting your targets so that this is a workable solution. I appreciate the opportunity to present this before you.
Thank you. With that, Representative Nelson renews his motion to lay over House File 767, and 767 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative
Thank Martin. You, Mr. Chair, members.
Okay, Representative Petersburg, are you available to go next? Representative New moves House File 818 to be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Petersburg. And Representative Petersburg, I understand you have an amendment, and I think staff may have prepared that in a written form. I thought I overheard. But Representative Petersburg.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I do. It's the A1 amendment, and basically it just changes 2016 to 2017. It's a simple amendment, and I would like that addressed as well, please.
Thank you. And it is being passed around, members, the A1 amendment. Representative New moves the adoption of the A1 amendment. Any discussion on the A1 amendment?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Seeing as I don't have the written one here yet, we're talking on line 2.5, changing January 1, 2016 to January 2017. I see it here in front of me now, yeah. So that's what the amendment is.
It is, correct.
Thank you.
Other discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A1 is adopted. Representative Petersburg with the bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for hearing this bill, and thank you, members of the committee, for your attention. Briefly, what this bill does is it requests the exemption from taxes and payments in lieu of taxation for machinery and other personal property that is owned by a natural gas municipal power plant that is being constructed in Owatonna. Obviously, those costs would be passed on to the taxpayers and others in the municipality, and it certainly is a nonprofit group. So we're just asking for you to consider that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I do have two testifiers, John Winter and Mark Fritsch, who would also like to give a brief testimony on this bill.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Welcome, Mr. Winter. Please introduce yourself to the record, sir.
Well, good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm John Winter. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency, or SMPA. SMPA is a joint action agency providing wholesale power deliveries to 18 municipal members around the state of Minnesota. They, in turn, serve about 112,000 retail customers. Our primary source of power is our 41% ownership of the Sherco 3 unit up in Becker, Minnesota. However, we've been diversifying our resource mix with wind, solar, biomass, and natural gas. And I'm here to talk to you today about natural gas. We're seeking a personal property exemption for the natural gas-fired engines that are the core of our new Owatonna Energy Station facility located near Owatonna. These new facility will consist of four such reciprocating engines made by Caterpillar, actually. New facility will put out about 39 megawatts of capacity, and the $44 million plant is currently under construction. The facility was included in the 2013 Integrated Resource Plan that was filed with the state of Minnesota and approved or accepted by the MPUC in 2015. In addition to filling the resource need for immediate generation capacity, the plan also replaces about 30 megawatts of lost generation that was lost during the September 2010 flood in Owatonna. The location of the plant will help local reliability in emergency situations. While this plant is larger than a similar plant we currently own in Fairmont, Minnesota, that was completed in 2014, it is very much similar to that plant and with natural gas reciprocating engines. In 2011, SMPA requested the legislature granted a similar exemption for that facility. The legislature's also approved nearly 30 of these types of exemptions for natural gas facilities around the state of Minnesota for personal property taxes. I should clarify that as a municipal power agency, SMPA is formed under Chapter 453 of the Minnesota Statutes and is a separate political subdivision and municipal corporation. As such, SMPA makes payments in lieu of taxes that are equivalent to those paid by a private entity, including the personal property tax portion of it. And this exemption would work in a similar fashion to that which would exempt taxes of a public entity as well. Identical language to the bill was included in House File 818 was in the tax bill that was passed by both the House and the Senate last year. And the fiscal note from that session indicated there was no impact on the state's general fund. SMPA has received resolutions supporting this legislation from the City of Owatonna, City Council, and the Steele County Board. The plant will have a positive economic impact on the city and the county, as well as providing services to all of our 18 municipal members. I thank you for this opportunity to appear before you this morning and your consideration of this legislation, and I'm happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Winter. Mr. Fritsch, please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Mark Fritsch. I'm the general manager of Owatonna Public Utilities and also the vice president of Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. And Owatonna Public Utilities is a community-owned, not-for-profit water, electric, and gas provider created by local residents about 80 years ago. The city was founded in 1854. And so 80 years ago isn't as old as the city. But we provide unique services to our community, and like I said, it was a not-for-profit organization. I'm here to support the personal property tax exemption for the natural gas-fired unit. And just a couple things to highlight. Mr. Winter did mention that reliability is a key issue, and we have a couple transmission feeds that come to the city, and this natural gas-fired unit will, for the first time, give us some ability to run most of our businesses down in Owatonna in case we lose those transmission feeds. So that local unit is considered a distributed type unit. And if you can imagine, for yourselves, if a tree falls on a line to your house and you lose power to your house for a few days until it's repaired, it's inconvenient. If we lose power to a city, it's a disaster. And so having local generation is absolutely important for our community. The economic impact in construction, labor, and suppliers is important to us as well. And without, like I said, that local generation, we'd be looking at some blackouts. So in summary, to support what Mr. Winter said, these similar tax exemptions are typical. The natural gas-fired unit will provide critical local reliability, and both the city and county support it. So I appreciate your support in before you this morning, and look forward to answering any questions you may have as well.
Thank you, Mr. Fritsch. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Okay, seeing none, members, any questions for Representative Erickson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, Ms. Show, I hate to point out a correction you have to make, but it's Petersburg, not Peterson, on your chart. Sorry.
The English teacher came forward.
Well, I was just surprised. I looked around to see if Representative Peterson was in the room, and then I realized, no, this is Representative Petersburg. Anyway, that's just to have some fun with you, Michelle. My question is, Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, this facility has already been built or is in the process of being built, or it's being added on to. I don't quite understand the language.
Mr. Winter.
Yes, President, the facility is currently under construction. It is a brand new greenfield facility. Excuse me, this is what you get when you have a four-year-old in daycare, by the way. Get a cold. Yes, under construction and greenfield facility with a substation located next to it. It's to be completed probably in service in the fall of this year.
Thank you,
Representative Erickson.
Thank you. Because I think the date was, I think the note from the Department of Revenue says it must be completed between January 1, 15 and January 1, 2016. So you're still working on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, members? Hearing none, Representative Petersburg, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and all I ask is that you consider supporting this bill and laying over possible inclusion. Thank you so much.
Thank you. With that, Representative New renews her motion that House File 818, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, the bill is laid over. Okay, next, Representative Hillstrom has House File 910. Representative Joachim moves that the committee entertain House File 910 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Hillstrom, welcome to the Property Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, it's my understanding that this committee has been talking a lot about the homestead property tax for property owned by veterans, and there are a number of proposals. This is another proposal that I hope you will consider in the mix. Under current law, homesteaded property owned by a veteran with a 70% or greater service-connected disability is eligible for market value exclusion up to $150,000. However, for a total and permanent disability of 100%, up to $300,000 of the market value is excluded. Members, there are veterans that are not total and permanent, but are simply totally disabled, which are excluded under both provisions. And so, members, while I raise the amount of the exclusion to $400,000, the most important piece to me is to allow veterans who have this 100% temporary disability rating to also be eligible. Members, that is the bill and the proposal. I think there's an amendment that was requested by some stakeholders that's really cleanup language. Do you have an amendment, Mr. Chair?
We do, Representative Hillstrom, and Representative Joachim moves the A2 amendment. Discussion on the A2, Representative Hillstrom, anything else on the A2?
Mr. Chair, it's just a cleaner way to do the same thing.
Okay, thank you. Members, discussion? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A2 is adopted. Any testifiers, Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, I know that there's at least one that wants to come and testify. I don't know if it's completely up in opposition to the bill, but there's some concern that, you know, local property taxpayers are paying this, and I know this committee is discussing whether the general fund should be used to assist in this area at all, Mr. Chair. So hopefully I can achieve what I want no matter how it's paid for, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Mr. May, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We certainly are supportive of veterans' benefits, and I certainly don't have an opinion on different parts of the bill. What we do think on the veterans' exclusion is that we would hope it could be a state program so that the cost of the program would be distributed equally throughout the state. Right now, the burden falls more heavily on those areas that are that house large veterans' facilities. And I can give you one example. In Carleton County, their levy is 6.8% higher than it would be without the veterans' exclusion. So they do inherit a large burden from this this provision. So our position is we'd like to see it be a state program, something with the property tax refund. And that would be my comments. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. May. Is Mr. Carlson here? Would he like to comment as well? Good morning, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I'm also speaking on behalf of the Association of Minnesota Counties. It pains me to indicate that we're in opposition because I have so much respect and admire Representative Hillstrom, but we also do oppose this bill. Right now, members, the current veterans exclusion excludes over $2.164 billion from our tax base. As Mr. May indicated, that means that other taxpayers, every farmer, every business, every homeowner located in the jurisdiction where these properties are located, pay additional taxes. That's at least $21 million annually. I further will indicate that the increase to over $400,000 is substantially in excess except in the average value of homes in any county in the state. Only Carver County has average value homes in excess of $300,000 currently. Most are substantially below that. Mr. Chairman, I do concur that we should honor our veterans for what they've done on our behalf, but we'll also point out that there are other members of our society who are equally deserving, such as firemen and policemen who receive no exclusion whatsoever right now. At best, they could qualify for the 1B classification, which is essentially a 55% reduction on the tax on the first $50,000 of home's values. So in conclusion, we do oppose. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Anyone else that would like to testify on the bill? Mr. Hilger, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Matt Hilgard. I represent the Association of Minnesota Counties. I just came in at the end of Mr. Carlson's comments, so I'll keep it brief, assuming that we have the same points of reference. The Association of Minnesota Counties has long requested that this exclusion be made into a credit. It's not that we are opposed to the benefits offered by this program. However, as Mr. Carlson, I'm sure, made you aware, the shift, the property tax shift is getting larger and larger, and now is over $2 billion worth of property tax value excluded. So I did reach out. I had the chance to email Representative Hillstrom a couple weeks ago saying that we are interested and willing to be part of a group that assesses how we can make that into a credit and make sure that it doesn't disproportionately impact veterans who are applying or making the process even more tedious for them, but figuring out a way to make this less impactful on the communities that these veterans are living in. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hilgard. Anyone else? You're drawing a lot of interest here, Representative Hillstrom.
Well, Mr. Chair, this is a standing program, and so at any time, Mr. Chair, I think you could make this state funded.
Okay. Please introduce yourself, sir.
Sure. Tom Diamond, DFL Veterans Caucus. I'd like to speak in support of this, but mainly speak in support of the series of bills that are being authored by a number of legislators trying to address this particular program. And most of them are modifications of what currently is existing law. For example, currently the exclusion for 100% veterans is 100% of the amount, but for 70 to 90%, it's only 50%, and some of us believe they ought to be based on the percentage, 70, 80, 90%. There's been some cases where surviving spouses fall through the cracks and don't get the benefit because of the timing of the death of the spouse, where the process, where where their rating is in the process, and also with the 100% disabled, whether they are 100% permanent or 100% disabled, but not permanent, and not to bore you or get into the lengthy how VA processes it, but you could have a condition where it's total, but there's a possibility of it improving, but when the veteran dies, obviously that's not the case. But having that at that stage, you then can't retroactively get the surviving spouse benefit. So there's some, you can call it technicalities, but they're very important pieces as to how you provide these benefits. And these are individuals who have been called up to serve the country and have served the country. And with the 70% and greater disabilities for the VA, are what they classify as catastrophic disabilities. These are, any definition, very seriously disabled individuals who have suffered greatly due to their service for the country. And I think it's very important that, however this gets worked out, there's a careful look at how these provisions work and that we can maybe come out of this with something that does a better job of serving the need that you have recognized in legislation currently. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Could you say your name again slowly for the record?
Tom Diamond, D-I-M-O-N-D.
Thank you, Mr. Diamond. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Questions, members? Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm not familiar with the disability designations of the VA, but it seems to me that it's a big step to deal with just saying a temporary disability. It could be someone's in a big accident and they're going to be in a body cast for 2 months, and that's a temporary 100% they can't work. But is that such that they should be, you know, forgiven this much in property taxes if they are actually going to recover? I mean, and I don't understand what the temporary disability is, but I think if we're going to enact this, we should really have a better definition in the law about what the expectation is, because quite honestly, a lot of our laws are assuming that people who are disabled can't work, and that's just not true. I used to work with a person with a master's in economics who was 100% legally blind, and he was just brilliant, even though he wasn't ever going to be able to drive a car. And I think that we need to keep updating our perspectives on, you know, what people with disabilities are and aren't able to do, and be clear in our definitions of what a temporary disability is. So if the author or anyone has some ideas on how the VA describes temporary, that would be helpful.
Representative Detmer's not here. We could phone a friend. Representative Huston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's my understanding that the way these proposals work is that each year you have to continue to certify that you have met this definition. And so it's my understanding that those discussions are happening in a number of proposals. I don't mean to change the definition of what the VA gets. I just happen to have someone who has this temporary disability classification for like 5 years. They'll be reviewed, and they're not eligible at all. And so ultimately, I don't think that that's the right answer either. If you have 100% disability, even if it isn't permanent, if you are not able to work, you should get the classification. So that's the best advice that I have. And I look forward, Mr. Chair, to continuing to work with all of the people who have proposals around this particular program.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. And Mr. Chair, I just think that we should be clear on what, you know, maybe some additional language that says they would not be expected to work for over, you know, the majority of the year, or some other kind of designation that's trying to define their economic need.
Other questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have heard from my counties, too, in regard to this exclusion, but I find it interesting, so I think we need to revisit the policy. I find it interesting, though, that this is a cost savings for tax refunds, because as the note from revenue says, the expansion of the eligibility is a net savings to the state due to a reduction in refunds, but then at the same time we have this increase other taxpayers, property taxpayers, because that exclusion then pushes the costs or shifts the costs to others. So I know this is a dilemma in some counties, and in honoring our veterans as we want to, and I believe we should, perhaps we need to be a little bit more creative in the way we work this out. I thought Mr. May started the conversation with a the idea of the credit, and maybe we need to look closer at this. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Hillstrom, anything else you'd like to share?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, as you evaluate this program and just make the decision on how it is that it should be implemented, I just want you to consider these folks as well. And Mr. Chair, I would ask that you lay over House File 910 for possible improvement.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. And with that, Representative Youakim renews her motion that House File 910 has amended be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, the House file is laid over. Thank you,
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Next, we're moving to House File 938, Representative Sundin. Representative Lean moves that House File 938 be entertained by the committee in light of possible inclusion. Representative Sundin, welcome.
Okay, 938. Okay, I believe 938 addresses the Carlton County ability to tax for recreational facility. It's called the Four Season Complex in Carlton, Minnesota. And we've been here before, 2006, 2013, looking for levy authority for the county in this unorganized township. There are townships adjacent to this facility that pitch in and help finance this community hockey rink, if you would like to label it as that. There's actually more to it than that. It's a community center, multi-use facility, and it's a critical piece to the local economy as well. There's quite a little bit of local economic activity generated by this facility. I have with me today Chair of the Carlton County Board, Gary Peterson, and he could go into a little more detail on this.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Gary Peterson, Carlton County Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee, for hearing our request. I think there was a handout that was given out, put together by our auditor, Paul Gassert. Some different information. I can maybe hit a few of the facts here and maybe answer any questions that you might have. Is that in Carlton County we have some unorganized townships, and one of them is Sawyer Township, that us county commissioners are the board for that unorganized township, and we meet with them, you know, once a year to kind of go over different things. And you know, as the board, unorganized townships, we levy for their fire protection, road and bridge. We have special legislation to allow the board, our county board, to levy for their ambulance. And like I said, this is a recreational complex. The Four Seasons recreational complexes, obviously they have ice there, you know, part of the year, and so it's, you know, we have some hockey going on there, but we also have public skating for the people in the county. Our elementary and high school in Carlton use the building for different things, you know, maybe for softball or baseball in the spring, or I've been to a lot of banquets there, retirements, weddings. The Deer Hunters Association uses that for their annual meeting every year. 4-H has used the building, and there's meeting rooms there. And our judge in Carlton County, when he retired, Judge Wolf, we had his big retirement there, and lots of people. And so it's used for year-round for many different activities. And Sawyer Township, you know, my mother actually grew up in Sawyer Township. Her family's pretty big there, and Sawyer Township, everybody goes to Carlton School, so they want to participate in this. And in 1997 to 2006, there was special legislation that Sawyer Township then kicked in to help build this recreational facility, and then it sunset in 2006, and now we're just asking that we would have this special legislation so they could kick in, just like you know, some of the townships that are there, that they have their own township board in Carlton School District. They kick in to it. And because obviously they want to help maintain this building for community use. And so that's what we're looking at doing. And at this time, we're not asking for any dollar limit, you know, because we would meet with the board and we would have to take the responsibility, you know, and get feedback from them in the Sawyer Township about that. I think it, the impact would be very little, you know, on them, compared to the net tax capacity that it has there. But I think this would be very good for the entire community.
Thank you. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Rarick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as an unorganized township, is it correct then that they do not have an annual meeting where the people set their own budget, you as the county board?
Yeah,
Mr.
said that.
Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, we have that meeting where we meet with the unorganized and we set their budget.
Yep. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so if I get this correct in my brain, this is a county facility that's in the Sawyer unorganized territory. It's really not a township. It's an unorganized territory. And everybody else in Carlton County, all the other townships pay to maintain it. Keep this facility up?
Mr. Peterson.
No, I think it would be the city of Carlton. I think, some of the other Twin Lakes Township. The people in those areas go to Carlton School District and, you know, are part of that area. But, you know, obviously in other townships would not be kicking into that.
Mr. Peterson, where is it? I think one of the questions Representative Nelson has, where is it located?
It's in the city of Carlton.
The city of Carlton.
This Four Seasons is in the city of Carlton.
So, Mr. Chair, Sawyer wants to continue contributing to help keep this facility up.
Right.
Because they also use it. That's,
right.
I guess that's the question I have.
So yes.
We're just continuing, Mr. Chair, we're just continuing what's already happened.
Yeah, it was to build it, the special legislation was for only 10 years, and then it ran out in 2006. So now we're looking at to do some special legislation so we can help maintain this recreational complex.
Other questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Sundin, any other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner Peterson, for coming and testifying today. This is a good community effort. The only thing that gave me concern originally was eliminating the cap on that, but then I realized that we have our own way of capping any excess levies in Carlton County. It's called a hanging tree in the courtyard of the courthouse, and it's actually a Greg David's oak, so it's nice and sturdy and appropriate for hanging commissioners and overreach. Thank you.
It's kind of tough in Carlton County. one quick question. Has there been any opposition to this expressed by anybody in Sawyer Township? Mr. Peterson.
At this time, we have not heard that. But we would have a public hearing to kind of deal with that. But at this time, we haven't heard any opposition.
Okay. Thank you. With that, Representative Lean renews his motion that House File 938 be laid over for possible inclusion, and House File 938 is laid over. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Representative Sundin, I think you have the next bill as well, House File 958, which will be moved by Representative Rarick, moves House File 958 to be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. The Cloquet Area Fire District is headed up by Captain Schroeder here to my left, and I've described Captain Schroeder as being ambitious, aggressive, and he's a good public servant. His ambition and his aggressiveness are leading up to a new facility in Cloquet, Minnesota. He's been working with the surrounding communities, putting together a good package, a better package for ambulance service and fire protection, and we'll be looking at a new facility at some point. The bill actually increases the levy limit, which is not going to be exercised immediately, but it also includes language for the fire district to incur debt as well. So this aggressive and forward-thinking piece of legislation is going to facilitate that.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Schrader, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. My name is Kevin Schroeder. I'm the fire chief of the Cloquet Area Fire District. We're down here once again this year trying to do some clarifications in the legislation that enabled us. On January 1st of 2010, the Cloquet Area Fire District became a singular entity in the state of Minnesota as the only independent special service district providing both fire and EMS services. We provide those services to different people. Some receive fire, some receive ambulance, some receive both, and that has created some difficulties with us over the year, or over the years, excuse me. The legislation in front of you does actually two main things. The first sections, one and two, are simple technical language adjustments to make sure the legislation meets the established name for us. When you get into Section 3 is one, the first major change. As Representative Sundin mentioned, we are requesting an increase in our EMS tax cap. We are asking to move from our current 0.019, which was a compromise language when we got our original, to 0.048%, which is the same rate allowed to all other EMS districts in Minnesota under Statute 144F. We do not plan to go to that maximum. Our current numbers for last year, we'd be right around the 0.029%. What the addition in the cap does for us is one of our long-term and original goals was to equalize cost of service for all those receiving it. And at our current rate right now, we have several of our members that are subsidizing the cost of EMS through the fire levy, and the other members that receive just EMS who are not paying a full share. So that would language would bring us into line with the other EMS districts in Minnesota following existing state law and equalize that playing field. Section 4 is the big one as we move forward to a new facility. In 2015, we initiated a study to look at consolidating a number of our older facilities into one new facility. As part of that study, Ehlers Incorporated here in St. Paul and several bonding attorneys went through our enabling legislation and came out looking for some clarification. We need to obtain a bond rating to move forward. A bond rating can either save money for our taxpayers or increase the cost for our taxpayers. So their main focus was to follow existing law that was clear and well vetted within Minnesota. Section 4 covers most of those areas. It narrows down the definition that we would work under to a municipality. It does add Section 412, which will allow us in the future to bond for capital equipment and not just facilities. In our history as a fire department, we have purchased an aerial apparatus through bonding that is a $1 million purchase. It happens about once every 25 years. So the equipment is important as we move into the future. The other thing at the end of that section is very important for clarification. It clearly splits who pays what cost. As I stated, we have member communities that receive one service or the other or both, and this language would clearly delineate that those that receive only EMS service only pay for any percentage of any bonding that is for EMS, and those that receive fire only pay for that. Right now, it's just silent in our language, and Ehlers and the bonding people weren't sure who paid for what or how that would work as far as if there were referendums or reverse referendums, as each piece of the building would be under different jurisdiction. So their recommendation is in front of you. The language was put together by them. As I stated, it follows existing state law, well vetted, and treats us as a municipality since fire and EMS services are traditionally municipal services. The last section is simply a stability of debt language that prevents a community from joining a fire district, approving a large capital purchase, and then backing out within a year or two to get out of that payment. So, with that, that's a very brief summary of what you have in front of you, and I'll take questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Schroeder. I got it right.
Thank you.
Anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? Questions, members? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having served on government operations, I don't think this, by changing the name and what they're doing, is a significant change in the board. But I think you might want to check with the chair of GovObstin and staff there to make sure that this doesn't have to go in front of them because of the mandatory referrals that are to government operations. But I don't think it does, but I think we should make sure that it doesn't before, so the whole tax bill doesn't have to go to GovOps because of it.
Thank you. Other questions, members? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Sundin or Mr. Schroeder, does Cloquet have a municipal liquor store?
Mr. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Erickson, no, they do not.
Representative Erickson?
I just mentioned that because I know in Princeton we have a municipal liquor store and it built this fabulous fire hall and a new police department. And it was, you know, it was good to see that the revenue from the municipal liquor could be used for something that I think that you probably need too. Thank you.
Other questions, members? One question I have, Mr. Schroeder, or Representative Sundin. 2.32 of the bill, it says, talks about the debt service can only be levied against taxable property within those municipalities receiving fire services. Help us understand that. Are fire services not available to, and you talked about the differentiation with Ehlers, I know, but I didn't quite follow it. Is fire service not available to every taxpayer within the fire district? Mr. Schroeder.
Mr. Chairman, you're correct. The way we are set up, we have three current member communities that receive both fire and EMS from us. We've just been approached by another neighboring township who wants to merge their fire department in. On the ambulance side, we cover a state-mandated primary service area. So that is a much larger geographic area in our area. We cover 275 square miles for that ambulance. Within there are four other townships that have their own fire departments. So those townships receive simply the EMS service from us and not the fire side. So that's where you get that distinction. We have a number of communities that receive both services and a number of areas that just receive the EMS side from us. So what that language does is make sure those receiving only EMS are not responsible for any fire-related costs.
Thank you. Are they also not included in the district technically then, too, Mr. Schroeder?
No, sir, they are, and they have representation on our board. It's just that they only receive one of the two services we provide. So they have a board member on our governing board. They are considered a member of our service area, but under the existing bylaws and the way we operate, they just receive the one service and not both.
But Mr. Schroeder, are they taxed the same as the areas that receive both services? Are they, Mr. Schroeder?
No, sir. Our taxpayers are taxed based on what services they provide. So we have both, in our existing legislation, our levy is split between fire service and EMS service. Some communities are taxed both of those levies. Some are taxed one. So EMS only area, it falls under our current 0.019%, the one we are asking to increase to 0.048. Our fire levy is completely separate. So you're only paying for the service that you are receiving. Some places receive two services, some places receive one.
Thank you. Members, other questions? Representative Sundin, would you like to any closing comments?
Just briefly, Mr. Chair, thanks for the hearing. And I'd like to thank Chief Schroeder for a lot of hard work. This represents a lot of homework on his part, getting all the parties together on a good bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Schroeder, you know the bill well. Thank you. With that, Representative Rarick,
moves to renews his motion that House File 958 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, members, House File 958 is laid over.
Thank you both.
Representative Lewick, House File 1085. Representative Barr moves House File 1085 be entertained by the committee and laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Lewick.
Thank you. I do have a couple of handouts here, if that's possible, to have them distributed. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Good morning. House File 1085 would seek to change a current requirement that we train all county assessors up to the level of qualification for commercial property. In general, a lot of our rural counties in particular, commercial property may represent 2-3% of all parcels, so their staffs are shaped to match that. They've got a significant number of people qualified at what they call certified Minnesota assessor level to take care of that workload, and then senior supervisors and other smaller segments of that staff would be qualified at the accredited Minnesota assessor level, CMA and AMA. The AMA assessor level encompasses a lot more complication, a higher level of qualification, and what's important to understand is that it also dictates a significant higher pay scale than the other class of assessors, so there is a significant difference in those job descriptions in the at the county level. So if we make them all the same, the higher pay scale, then whether they're going to do the work or not, you're going to be paying for the higher pay scale. So that's kind of a short and sweet. The reason I'm here is to try to save our county taxpayers some dollars and allow them to shape that workforce as necessary to get the work done. Mr. Chair, I do have one testifier here, and I'm certain there'll be the agency will be interested in providing their input on this matter also.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. Mr. Johnson, please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, my name is Tom Johnson. I'm the administrator of Nobles County. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. It does cause a pretty significant impact for Nobles County, and I passed around a small spreadsheet there that's based on some assumptions, granted. From our experience, we have hired three into the assessing department over the last 3 years, and not one person has applied even with significant qualifications. So we've had to start them at the very ground level and go through the training. And so we've estimated 5 to 7 years for them to achieve the AMA as it's currently documented. If you look at the spreadsheet, that costs us some over 2% added to our levy, our total levy. And over the seven-year period, it's almost $1.8 million. Again, I think this is probably a worst-case scenario, but from the experience we have, it's pretty realistic. About 95% of our parcels in our county, and even more, a higher percentage than a lot of our neighboring counties, are in fact residential and farmland, where the CMA has the capable training to assess those properties and has been for a number of years, and we haven't had problems with that because the training has been adequate for the CMAs. One of our fears is with the new accreditation, we've already had one person leave that could not achieve the AMA, just couldn't pass the test. So it's a very strenuous program, and chose to move on because knowing that the credentials were required by 2019, he started looking for a job and has moved on since then. in the nine southwest counties, under the current plan, according to the Department of Revenue website, there's only two communities, Redwood Falls and Marshall, that require AMA right now because of the number of industrial commercial. So we believe that there's way too much required for what we need to get out of them and get accurate. Nobles County fully supports extended training, extensive training to make sure that even the CMAs, if they're allowed to go forward, get the appropriate training to properly assess the properties that we see. And also out in rural towns, you don't see a whole lot of new houses and you don't see a whole lot of change out there, so it's very repetitive. Currently, Nobles County has six local assessors. Five of them are not AMA qualified, and all have told us that they'll no longer assess properties at that point. That'll bring back 19 jurisdictions of the 31 jurisdictions in the county. We've operated with a staff of four in Nobles County for a number of years. We need to double that staff to cover if we all have to go AMA. So we'll have to go up to eight staff, and that is what the spreadsheet shows. That's the added four staff that we're predicting the cost will be to the taxpayers over the next 7 years. And one personal statement in a long career in industry as well is AMA certification, as with any advanced certification or degree, doesn't in itself guarantee best results. It's a certificate that says you've taken all the training, you've passed the tests, and you've passed all the requirements of that, but it doesn't in itself guarantee you're going to have a great assessor.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Actually, we do have Mr. Cummings, I think, wants to testify.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, just a quick note with that information that was passed out. There was a letter from the Aiken County Commissioner and former assessor. And to give an example, and I'm intimately familiar with that county along with Crow Wing County, similar circumstance. They've got six assessors. What's worked well for them based on the types of classification of properties that they have to assess, they've got three people that are qualified at the higher level and three at the CMA level. This will force all of them go to the higher level, and likely those other three will probably never assess a piece of commercial property because we don't have it. With 2% of all the parcels commercial. But as a county commissioner, he's looking. He deals with labor negotiations every year. And if you change all the job descriptions to the highest classification, you have to change the pay scale too. So it's only appropriate. And the bargaining units certainly recognize that. So we are talking a huge long-term increase in cost if we continue down this road, and I think Commissioner Meany really points that out in his letter.
Thank you, Representative Luke. Mr. May, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom May, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. Each year we prepare a position statement for the legislature, and it includes our mission statement. I just want to read that real quick before I make my comments. The mission of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is to provide education and information to promote excellence in property appraisal and assessment administration through professional development with the highest ethical standards. With that said, we are fully supportive of education and certification for assessors throughout the state. With that said, we have been dealing with this issue for several years. We've said in the last two sessions that if we didn't solve it, that we were going to be opposed to any kind of repeal. We've revamped our whole education system. We've moved towards the 2019 date, and we continue to do that. And we're helping all assessors throughout the state meet those qualifications of accredited Minnesota assessor. I would say that many times when we compare commercial to ag, and I've held this chart up in front of the Ag Committee and the Tax Committee in the past. This is what assessors have to do to administer ag homestead. So being from the metro area and not an ag expert, I would say I'd rather value a commercial building than do this. Just to level the playing field a little bit on that issue. We have worked with the Department of Revenue last year to arrive at compromise language, and that has been introduced this year. It's House File 1431. Representative Marquardt has introduced that. We're comfortable with that language. Without that language, we would oppose an outright repeal of this provision. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Main. Mr. Cummings. Good morning, Mr. Cummings.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I don't know if I told Representative Blewett this, but I was born in Aiken, Minnesota. Yes, so I'm from the same hometown.
He supports your bill, Representative Blewett.
Absolutely. Wanted to thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I also wanted to note that Mr. Klockseem is here, and he can, if we need to go farther into depth about the certification, he's here. And then I also wanted to note that Mr. Ouellette is here if there were questions about the revenue estimate. This is an important hearing, as accreditation of assessors is key to ensuring that all Minnesotans, no matter where they live, have the assessment laws applied fairly, appropriately, and equitably all across the state. When we talk about to assessors across the state, they understand the importance of assessor accreditation, but they also hold out hope that hearings like these will lead to a lessening of their requirements to be trained and accredited. The current law enacted in 2013 requires every individual that appraises or physically inspects property to determine valuation must obtain licensure as an accredited Minnesota assessor by 2019. House File 1085 modifies the rules for assessor accreditation and assistance to county assessors. The proposal repeals the current accreditation requirements. The intent of the original law was to ensure the fair, equitable, and consistent assessment across the state, to develop a pool of qualified assessors to take over the duties of county assessors in case of retirement or attrition, to address constituent concerns about assessor practices, to address inconsistent assessment practices, to create a level of public trust in the fairness and equity of assessment, to compromise with individuals who wanted to have local assessing officers offices abolished and require all counties to use a true county assessment system where there are no local assessors and only county assessor employees, and to reflect the professional nature of assessment work, like CPAs, electricians, attorneys, building officials, etc. Licensure provides accountability, credibility, improved quality, uniformity, and professional growth. Practice suggests that licensure requirements will result in more professional, competent workforce. That's why we see licensure requirements in other professions, like CPAs and electricians, as I said. Since the 2013 law has passed, the Department of Revenue made a number of changes to prepare for more demand from individuals looking to achieve AMA licensure. We doubled our number of week-long courses offering for AMA licensure. We worked with MAAO to create additional courses that address assessment concerns. Some of the specially created classes relate to the assessment of agricultural properties, apartment properties, and ag homestead. A key part of the AMA accreditation process is to write a form appraisal report and have it graded by the State Board of Assessors. To handle the anticipated increased demand, the State Board of Assessors recruited and selected more report graders. To date, a number of assessors have taken steps towards AMA licensure. However, there is more to come. The property tax system has become more complicated over the years, not less so. And I know as I'm meeting with members of this committee just to do some meet and greets, that's what everyone is seeming to tell me, that the property tax system is becoming more and more complicated, and at times they are concerned about ensuring that every county is doing it the same. Legislators are familiar with the expanding number of property tax classifications, over 50, the highest of any state. Our cumbersome agricultural homestead process, Mr. May showed the associated flowchart, and some of the issues we have had in recent years. Having educated assessors with greater knowledge, common education, greater experiences help to achieve consistency. Property owners have more access to information than ever before. Property tax information is transparent. Since property owners can look at comparable properties online, uniform treatment of property is essential. Uniform assessment practices across assessors are really essential to upholding the public trust. Part of the intent of current law is to create consistency among assessors. Inconsistent assessment issues have required the legislature to review some assessment practices, including fermentation tanks that was brought up a few years ago, and now we are talking about agricultural chemical containment facilities. Requiring education like other professionals help to create the environment of consistency and equitable assessment statewide. Finally, both the legislature and taxpayers have expressed concerns about agricultural values and the validity of agricultural assessments. Providing more consistent education on ag values puts assessors in a better position to uniformly value ag property. More education allows assessors to discuss what should be included in ag value and how to make ag valuation work well statewide. One of the purposes of the licensure laws was to ensure that properties would be still assessed in the case of a qualified license assessor leaving or retiring. Under the bill, there would be knowledge gaps in offices if only one person had the appropriate licensure for certain properties, and that one person left. Clearly, there is potential for retirements. Taxpayers should still expect the same level of assessment quality. Having higher quality assessors in place in case of retirement or attrition is good for Minnesota taxpayers. In addition, Mr. Chair, this could result in assessors employed by the county having much less training than some local assessors. Fair, uniform assessments are a goal we all share. The Department of Revenue has invested time in preparing to support the assessor community in meeting the 2019 timeframe. In closing, Mr. Chair, at the end of last session, we worked with all interested parties to come up with a negotiated agreement that works to uphold high assessment standards while understanding the realities across the assessing community in Minnesota. We believe we can continue to work towards an agreement this session. We thank you, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation through session on this bill and other important bills impacting Minnesotans. And I look forward to going to visit my hometown again. Maybe catch a cup of coffee with Representative Lewick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Cummins. And I think the only thing I would say needs correction is I think there's over 55, and some would argue there are even more than that in terms of the subclassifications. We have a question from Representative Barr.
I did not have a question.
You did not? Okay. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first of all, did this initiative, Mr. Cummins, come from the department or did it come from within the assessor organization?
Mr. Cummins.
Mr. Chair and members, from what I remember, one of the things that happens every year in the Property Tax Committee, or seemingly, is that there's an issue that comes up to say that there's an assessment issue going on in the state in which people from various counties are being treated disparately, right? This was an initiative that was championed by Senator Scoy as he was thinking about how to work with assessment practices, something that he consulted with the Department of Revenue. We understood, obviously, what the need was. This was not in our department bill. This was something that Senator Scoy championed and that we, frankly, worked with him on to ensure that it could be administered well.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Cummins, are you working now with Representative Lewick to figure out this compromise, or are you working with someone else to figure out this possible compromise?
Mr. Cummins.
Well, I know, Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson I have yet to sit down with Representative Lewick this session. I know we have talked last session. We've talked extensively with MAAO, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, to try and work on a solution. We look forward to continuing to work with Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, you mentioned a lack of consistency with the storage tanks and fertilizer containment structures. Well, I think that falls way above the pay grade of our local county assessors determining which, in fact, they would fall into for tax classifications. That goes all the way up the chain and into the counties and even here at the state, talking about those two very large topics. My comment, other comment, is that I think we need to do something. Maybe the total repeal is not the answer. I haven't had a chance to look at 1431 yet. I certainly will. But just in my local township, for example, mainly agricultural, I think we had two commercial parcels in the entire township. We paid the county assessor a certain amount to do each parcel, and then our local assessor took care of the rest of the agricultural land in the township. And our local assessors are leaving the field en masse. They do not want to, I'm making a sweeping statement, but because of age and the lack of income, financial incentives, whatever, a lot of them are choosing not to receive this AMA certification. And that's these numbers given to us by the Nobles County assessor are very concerning. It's going to lead to a very large increase in the cost when the county people take on the assessing for the entire county, which I think is going to happen eventually if we continue down this same path. So I think something needs to be done to allow, at least in the more rural townships, the ability to continue with our local assessors and not have to achieve this extremely high level of certification.
Thank you, Rep. Anderson. Mr. Cummins?
I think, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, you bring up some good points. I think one of the things that we want to just sort of think about in the ag space, I know that there's a study coming up from Representative Lean. There is laws seeming to be changed all the time. There is another, if you look at some of the ways in which there is linkages, there's something with trusts and estate tax and homesteads. I mean, there's some complications here that we want to ensure that as changes goes along, that we have highly qualified people in these areas. Changes in the economy are happening. Changes in tax laws are happening. There could be changes in the types of practices that are happening. And so, we want to make sure that wherever you live in the state, that you have a confidence that it will be, assessed in a way that is consistent with everyone else in the state. Now, with that said, Representative Anderson, we hear you, right? We hear that the pressures that are going on with counties. We hear people wondering how we're going to make this transition, how we're going to ensure that that's happening. So I hear the balance that people are trying to reach in this area.
Thank you. And we have a question from Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but the parallel was drawn. I couldn't resist talking about comparing to the electrical licensure. And when we look at the electrical licensure, you begin as an apprentice, you become a journeyman, and then you can become a master. But we do not require that every electrician become a master. What we do require is ongoing education for the level that you're at. And within our industry, we have multiple areas of training and certifications. Again, we do not require everyone get all of those. So I would ask that we look at this and see if ongoing education is a better route than just requiring licensure, because not everybody requires your top level of licensure.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Representative Rurick hits the nail right on the head, and that's the fundamental problem here. There's a group of properties out there that require one general, and I want to be very careful, general but complicated approach to fairly and properly evaluate that. There's another group, and I'll just call them the commercial special properties, that require a different approach. And that is you have to factor in the ability or the potential for the income to come off that property. And it's as different as teaching mathematics in high school and teaching English literature. It's both require expertise, but we don't require our mathematics teachers to get a license to be an English teacher or vice versa. It's wonderful if they want that career for they will move either place. But this is basically a perfect example. If we said today to the trades, guess what? You get your master's as a plumber or electrician or you name it, or over the next couple of years, you're out. You can't practice. I certainly wouldn't tolerate that. I don't think anybody else did. And that's what we're saying to these people out there. And I want to go back again. Those numbers, Representative Anderson, are the real deal. And they stretch across all our rural counties. What we're doing here is we're going to require, for example, Aiken County, 2% of the parcels are commercial. We're going to have all the assessors be qualified to do that. And so they're going to focus the bulk of their training on something they're going to spend 2% of their time on, and then we're going to hurt the other part, the other element. So again, I appreciate my colleague from Aiken, the things he said about making sure we do this fairly equally across the state we agree 100% on that. But what we did when we made that change, we put a one-size-fits-all, and it's kind of doing more damage out there, because when you take all the resources and force them into qualifying to become a commercial appraiser, then you lose the time and expertise and resources to focus on, for Aiken and Crow Wing County, the vast bulk of the work that's before those assessors. So, and I do have another, we have another testifier that certainly can provide another insight if we've got time for that, Mr. Chair.
Representative, we're going to take just a couple more questions first. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I am concerned about totally repealing an expectation that we have a higher level of assessment, and I think that this bill probably goes farther maybe than you had intended in terms of taking away that expectation totally. But it does strike me that the certified Minnesota assessor has 4 years to achieve the higher level of accreditation, and I'm wondering if Mr. Cummings could summarize for us what is expected in that 4 years, or someone else, in terms of the training. It doesn't sound to me like it's you drop out of the workforce and you're in college for 4 years. It sounds like it's a part-time endeavor, but it would be really helpful to better understand what's expected and why that's seen as a burden at this point by many.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. And I guess we got a new testifier to answer that question.
For the record, my name is John Kloxine. I'm the Assistant Director in the Property Tax Division for the Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Kloxine.
Yes, before I go on to the requirements to jump from the certified Minnesota assessor to the accredited Minnesota assessor, I want to clarify a little misunderstanding that's going on in the committee, that this license level is strictly for commercial appraisal. That would be kind of an error, so to speak, in that this license level is generally designed to gain a greater understanding on all types of appraisal and assessment procedures.
Thank you, Mr. Kloxine. Representative Loeffler?
And then if you could briefly describe sort of what the training burden is over that 4 years.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative? The additional requirements over the certified Minnesota assessor are you must complete a residential form report, which is an abbreviated appraisal of a property. You have a residential case study exam that you must complete. And then you have courses that you must take. You have two income courses to get you familiar with producing or appraising income property. You have assessment administration, which gives you a greater understanding of the procedures surrounding assessment. And then you have an elective that you can choose, of which the Minnesota Board of Assessors has various courses that the appraisers can choose from. And then in addition, you have to complete the 15-hour USPAP course, which is the Uniform Standards of Professional Appraisal Practice.
Thank you, Mr. Klopstein. And members, we do have two more bills we need to get through. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, if we could just get a better sense of how many hours those four classes would take. You said there's 15 hours in the uniform law things, but how many hours are involved in the four classes that are required?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Klopstein.
Each one of those courses is a week-long course.
So, Mr. Chair, it's basically 1 week a year over that 4 years plus the 15 hours.
Mr. Chair, Representative, if you choose to do it that way, that would be correct.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Carlson. Nelson. I'm sorry, Nelson.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, Mr. Representative, or Mr. Chair. Just a couple of things. One is using the example that Representative Rarick and has been used by the department about an electrician. For a shop to operate, they have to have one master, and the people below them can be journeymen or apprentices, but to operate as a shop, they have to have at least one master. The way I read this bill, and maybe I'm wrong, we're getting rid of that requirement that at least somebody has that top requirement. Is Mr. Chair and Representative Louis, is that what I'm reading, or am I reading that wrong?
Thanks for the question. No, what this does is basically puts us back to where we were before we put the new requirements on. Your county assessor still has to meet a certain set of requirements. And, you know, it's kind of ironic. Last year I offered a bill that simply said you will have to be qualified to assess the property that you're assessing. In other words, if there's an item that requires a master electrician, then that's who's got to do it, or he's got to be looking over his shoulder. Obviously, the agency we couldn't agree that that was the way to approach it. This just sort of turns the clock back to the way it was. We've got a whole list of requirements that the county assessor's office is responsible for, way beyond simply the specifics. They also are responsible for what goes on out there at the local level with the non-government assessors, because ultimately they are the ones that are held accountable for all the assessments that go on within that county, regardless of who does them. So this simply turns the clock back. What we're trying to do is get back to normal here so we don't just really jam some huge long-term expenses on all of our rural counties in particular.
Thank you,
Mr.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That gives me a little more comfort here. It's just it was brought up earlier, I remember from previous years where we had this big fight about tanks and how you assess tanks and all that, and I think some of this legislation came out of that. I agree that if we're just trying to right size this so that we have the right people assessing the properties, but it gives me some pause that we've had other bills and on other committees I've heard where we've had to push requirements out because for whatever reason counties and county boards have not been able to get the right people on or get the proper training in the timely fashion, and things have come up. So I have some concerns about this, but I guess some of my concerns have been alleviated.
Representative Lloyd.
A very quick follow-up to Representative Nelson. Can I give you an example of the two counties that I represent? We have a huge amount of lakeshore, huge amount. That in itself is, it's complicated, it's unique. But if you go to Rock County, you get down to Southwest, they don't even have a lake there. And so here's where that mismatch that really, really concerns me. I want our assessor's office and our county commissioners to be able to focus their training, which a lot of, they'll get it right from Mr. Cummings' folks, on those kind of things that represents the workload before them. Now, why would Rock, you know, it'd be good that the assessor's going to need to know about in case somebody decided to make a lake out there in his county, but the rank and file would have no need for that. And that varies. I mean, you get into a heavy industrial area where it's almost all commercial property. There's no question that those people have to be at that higher level because that's the work before them. So, again, I say I do have another testifier that can kind of provide another perspective if there's time for that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And please state your name and
Mr. Chair, members.
For the record, please.
And Ken Sewell of the Minnesota Association of Townships. And a lot of the things, as you can see, have been said, so I won't repeat. But I think there are some false premises that things are false assumptions that are being made about what requiring everybody to get the highest level of accreditation would do. When I went to law school, you had to study the UCC in order to sit for the bar exam. That's no longer required. Don't ask me one question about the UCC. I had to do it at that time. I've never practiced in that area of law. You wouldn't want me to advise you in that area of law. You can require somebody to get a lot of extra training, and if it's not applicable to what they're actually doing, you tend to forget it. You don't stay current with that amount of training. I believe it's a Rarick's approach of requiring the ongoing training and continuing education and having that targeted to the actual skills is a very important piece. We have people who are trained at the same level now who make different assessments. So requiring them to have the same level of training at one more higher level doesn't mean that they're not going to have differences. There's a reason we have 56 different or 57 different property classifications in the state. Everyone had its big basis and reason at the time that it was adopted. We're going to continually have changes made in the tax code and the way the properties are to be assessed under statute, which means no matter what level of assessment or no matter what level of certification you're at, you're going to need to stay current with those changes or you're going to have problems that occur as we've seen currently. And so I just wanted to point that out, that simply having a higher level of certification does not in any way assure resolving the differences that are out there. It does not assure any sort of uniformity. It simply means that person is going to do the best of their job. I also want to make one quick comment on behalf of the locals who are, frankly, we are very concerned about losing local assessors and having one more local control issue taken over by the county by force, not that the county essentially want it, but they're going to be forced into it because there aren't the local assessors. That's the major concern, because the local assessors understand what's actually there at that local level. They understand how the property is truly being used, what's being given, and if you take that up one level removed and say, well, by having it at the county, we're going to have more uniformity, no, you're still getting the differences. This is going to be a different type of difference. This can be a difference between counties instead of locals, and you're going to lose that local input. You're going to lose that local voice, which is a major, major concern for us. With that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. Any questions from members? Hearing none, are there any other folks in the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Mayer with the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers.
Thank you.
Again, I just want to make one quick clarification. This is not the highest designation that's available to assessors. There's a senior accredited that's above this. All county assessors have to be senior accredited. And many of our assessors also have credentials through the International Association of Assessing Officers, and they can have credentials through the Appraisal Foundation. So just to let you know, this is not the highest, and I think it might be helpful if we sent something to everybody that shows exactly what is needed to obtain the accredited Minnesota assessor. That may clarify.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Thanks for that clarification. Closing comments, Representative Lloyd.
No, except I'm ready to work with everybody on this. And again, I just can't stress enough the huge cost that this thing is going to roll down on counties, and it'll go on year after year. Every time that they do a new labor negotiation with the new job descriptions, they're going to wipe out, quote, the journeyman out there, and they're all going to be, you know, best example, they're all going to have to start at the master's level, and you have to be fair to people when you change those kind of qualifications. You got to pay them for what they're qualified for. I mean, that's something I think we all accept. But if they're not even going to get to work on what they're qualified for, that is just a terrible waste of taxpayers' money. And their skills. I mean, we want to keep those people focused on the work before them and not on something they'll probably never do in the normal course of their job description. So thank you again. I appreciate it. And again, I'm ready to work with everybody on this.
Thank you, Representative Lewick. And with that, members, Representative Barr renews her motion to lay over House File 1085 for possible inclusion. Next, we have Representative Garofalo has made his appearance, and we look forward to hearing his bill. And Representative Whalen moves House File 36 for possible inclusion. Leader your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Thanks for having me. And Chairman Drazkowski, thank you for scheduling this bill for hearing. Members of the committee, let me first of all state that as with any change in classification rate, this is neither a tax reduction nor a tax increase. It is simply a modification of how local levies are assessed across their jurisdiction. What we have right now is that in current law, different jurisdictions are assessing the same property with the same use at different classification rates. So what the bill does is on page 2 makes it clear that these storage units that are in condominiums are classified at a 4BB rate. What's happening right now is that, again, we're not talking about commercially owned condominiums. We're not talking about those that are rented out. We're not talking about those that are used for commercial purposes. These are residential storage units that are being classified, in my opinion, misclassified. What this bill does is it standardizes that classification, so it's a 4BB rate, uniformity across our state. The research I've done on it is that the vast majority of jurisdictions are already doing it at 4BB, but there's a couple outliers, and this clarifies that. Now, Mr. Chairman and members, I did pass out a letter from the department, or I had a copy of a letter. I don't know if it was distributed to members of the committee or not, which elaborates on that further. Other than that, I can defer to Mr. Hines from nonpartisan research if I said anything wrong. I'm happy to take any questions.
So, Representative, you're not creating a new classification. You're just clarifying these properties that exist, what classification they should be assigned.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
All right. Questions from the members. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I just get my head around this again. We're talking a condominium unit. So if it's, say, a condominium unit that's like similar to an apartment building, in an apartment building, often you'll have storage for your apartment elsewhere in that building. They're classifying these storage units or this type of storage differently in some places than others, and that's what we're talking about, or is it something similar to that?
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, that may be one of the classifications this covers. What I'm thinking more of is imagine you have individual separate property IDs, storage facilities that are owned by residents. They're not owned by businesses, and they're simply used to function as a garage would. And these are not used for commercial purposes. They're not owned by commercial individuals. That's the intent of the legislation. The description you're bringing up, I don't think those have separate property IDs, but I don't know. As always, I would defer to our highly competent, incredible nonpartisan research. But that's the intent of this, is that right now these properties that I've described in some jurisdictions are getting the 4B classification and others are getting the 4BB classification. In many cases, the same developer of the properties. So it's clarifying.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, given that we treat garages on a single-family home and as part of that home, I can understand if someone condominiumizes the garages associated with a residential condominium that they should have the same classification. But we have condominiumized office buildings, big-time storage, warehouse spaces, and I don't see any real definition in here that really limits it to that garage function that would be maybe equivalent to a maximum size of a two-car garage or a two-and-a-half size garage, as opposed to someone who, you know, may have a warehouse-sized pole barn that's been condominiumized, and they are really providing a warehouse function, which is different than the equivalent of a garage. And so can you explore a little bit more with us why you didn't have a a much more restrained definition?
Representative Ruffles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, if you look on page 2 of the bill, lines 2.6 to 2.7, I think that covers your concern. It's certainly a warehouse function or commercial purpose would not meet the definition of this expanded definition of 4BB.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We always need to understand the exception. So what is the biggest and what are the, give me examples of the types of facilities that you would expect should have be treated as single-family storage units just because of the ownership model that they're using.
To the question, Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, again, in the research I've done, the vast majority of these properties are already getting the 4BB classification. So in terms of my answer to you, I'm going to narrow it down to specifically my knowledge of facilities that are not getting the 4BB classification, and that is that an individual owns a home where they simply don't have a large enough lot to build a large garage on, or to put their put an extra car in, or maybe they're a Harley club, and he's got three or four Harleys that he maintains in this facility. He's got a TV hanging on the wall, kind of turns into a man cave, and has his buddies over there. Hypothetical examples of what these facilities may be used for right now. But the relevant part of this, Representative Loeffler, is that, again, these properties built by the same owners having unique individual property IDs are already having divergent classifications across the state. If you look at the letter from the department that's in your packet, I believe the year on that is 2012. And you'll see that in that letter, they actually go farther. They designate these things as things that should be eligible for the homestead classification rate. So this is just a matter of making sure that the properties are in the 4BB classification. Again, if they are commercially owned, if they're part of, if someone tries renting these out for additional purposes, if they're using them for commercial properties, none of that would apply to the 4BB classification rate. Think of it as something that would be if a person had a large garage attached to their house. Those would be the appropriate uses for it.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And the letter does say, in some instances, it may be located in the immediate proximity of the homestead. I think within a reasonable distance makes sense, because if the Harley man cave that you described is up near a lake area, I think that would be seasonal rec, especially if it's more than a half hour from the person's home.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, you'll notice that on page 1, where do we see it? Mr. Hines, where's the exception for seasonal rec that would blow this away? I read it in the bill last night. I know it's there.
Mr. Chairman, I think on 2.1 or 2.2 and 2.3, it's other than seasonal recreation.
Representative Groff.
Yeah.
Any other questions for members? Any testifiers? Anybody from the audience? Thank you. Would you state your name, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Patrick Hines. I represent the Community Association Institute of Minnesota. It is an association of residents and property managers and other stakeholders and townhome associations.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Our concerns are precisely what was being discussed by the members before I came up here. We don't oppose the legislation on the classification point. What we are concerned about is the definition of storage unit on line 2.6. That term is not defined in Chapter 515B, so as Representative Nelson pointed out, it could be read to include a storage unit that is associated with a residential unit, the kind you might have in the garage or in the basement of an apartment building. The revenue letter dated February 8, 2012, that Representative Garofalo referenced, discusses units that have their own legal description and that are individually owned. So we think that the definition of storage unit in the bill could be aligned more closely with what the Department of Revenue is discussing in its revenue notice, And if that language were refined, then the bill would accomplish Representative Garofalo's goal relative to the Harley Man Cave and not have the unintended consequence of bringing these other storage units into the property tax classification system.
Thank you. Representative Garofalo.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hines had the opportunity, and he and I spoke briefly last week, and I certainly am willing to adjust the language to accomplish the stated goals that I mentioned earlier.
Any other questions? Any other testifiers? With that, closing comments?
Mr. Chairman and members, I appreciate you granting this bill a hearing and hope that it is included in the recommendations to the tax committee.
Thank you, Representative Garofalo, and Representative Whalen renews her motion to lay House File HF 36 over for possible inclusion. Okay, next we'll call Representative Anderson for House File 1178. And while Representative Anderson is getting seated, Representative Anderson moves his own file, 1178, for possible inclusion. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to get up and stretch, so thanks for hearing my bill, 1178, this morning. This bill isn't asking for any funding. There's no fiscal note with it. It's been scored as neutral by the Department of Revenue. They look at such things as efficiency, compliance, responsiveness to economic conditions and such. What this bill does, it allows qualifying cities to use the TIF funding mechanism, taxing mechanism, to help finance construction of workforce rental housing in greater Minnesota. The bill is supported by the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, the Greater Minnesota Partnership, and also by the League of Minnesota Cities. And we feel it's an important tool that could be used in the counties outside the metro area to help businesses that have a designated need for additional housing to get that housing going, market rate rental housing, so they can expand their businesses in greater Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers who would like to say a few further words on the bill.
Thank you. Please state your name and association for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Heather Corcoran with the League of Minnesota Cities, a statewide association with 833 of the state's 853 cities. Thank you to Representative Anderson for carrying this bill today and for the division for hearing it. In a brief moment, I'll turn it over to Michael Brevers from Melrose to tell you a city-specific story of how this would help their community. But before I do, I wanted to summarize briefly the issue that this aims to solve. As Representative Anderson said, this is a situation where in a lot of communities in greater Minnesota, there's employers who want to grow their business, want to expand and hire more folks. There isn't housing there to have those potential new employees live in. Many of you are probably familiar with the situation. It's been a topic at the legislature and one that the League has focused on in the past few years. Ever since 2013, we had some listening sessions in Springfield and Thief River Falls. We've heard about the topic from communities like Roseau, Worthington, Jackson, and other places that continue to speak about the challenges. More recently, Wilmer, Windham, Perham, Duluth, East Grand Forks, Crookston, and Melrose, as I said, share this challenge. The League has been working on this issue, as I said, and supports a variety of solutions potentially from the legislature to help address this. I think you have a one-pager that describes kind of the three opportunities that we're looking at, primarily this bill that would create a TIF authority for cities to use for workforce housing, the deed grant program that was funded by the legislature last biennium, and we thank the legislature for their support with that and continue that support, and then the tax credit proposal that was heard about 2 weeks ago in Representative Garofalo's committee. And some of you might recognize this indeed concept and proposal as it was included in last year's House version of 848. So we encourage and are hopeful that it would be included this year in the division report. With that, I'll turn it over to Michael Brethorst from the City of Melrose to tell you a little bit about how this would be helpful for their community.
Thank you, Ms. Corcoran. And Mr. Brethorst.
Thank you for the opportunity. As she said, my name is Mike Brethorst. I'm the city administrator for the City of Melrose, Minnesota. I've been a city administrator for about 10 years, and before that I was a community development director for over 6 years. And so through that time, I've been involved in several tax increment development districts, probably 16 of them to be specific in greater Minnesota. So as Heather just talked about, as well as Representative Anderson talked about, our community of Melrose exceeds and meets every single one of these requirements to meet this need. This past winter, we applied for the Workforce Housing Grant, and we thank the state for the opportunity to apply for that. However, we were not successful in receiving those funds. And because of that, our project is now currently in jeopardy to see additional workforce housing. There is just a limited amount of resources for an unlimited amount of need out there. So again, we thank the state for that. And so really, we're looking for a tool to add to our toolbox to see development in greater Minnesota. Prior to September 8th, as I mentioned, we met this need. Now, since September 8th of this year, we have even more of a greater need than we had before that time. During this day on September 8th, we had a fire that destroyed our downtown. We've now referred to this as the 400 block, and I've actually testified to this fact once before this year. As for the fire marshal, this is undetermined for the fire, but this fire has dislocated 11 businesses. This represents 23% of our downtown. The fire also displaced 9 families, and this represents 33% of our housing in our downtown. The city of Melrose has requested a lot of help in regards to trying to understand what the true economic impact of this devastating fire was. One estimate shows a $1.8 million loss in labor if none of the families were to return. Also a $5.7 million in economic activity if none of the businesses were to return. We're fortunate in Melrose because we have very committed and dedicated people that want to stay in our community. Now, the estimated reconstruction cost of our 400 block to rebuild is over $2.3 million. This is a mixed-use housing development as well as commercial use. Now, after you assess this property out, the assessed market value goes down to $1.4 million. So that means there's a gap for the developer, the property owner, of $900,000. There is no bank in the world that's going to fund a $900,000 blue sky gap. There's no insurance policy out there that will ensure a $900,000 gap to build a new reconstruction. Now, in conclusion, our community has 4 letters of support that shows that we have a need for workforce housing. We've completed a housing survey. We have 1% vacancy rate. Our local HRA has 30 units that are at capacity. We have 15 families on the waiting list right now. There is a need, and today we are simply proposing a tool for cities to apply for in very limited, specific requirement areas in which there's a need. That's 3%. That's 15-mile radius around a community, so not everybody can apply for this. So our recent fire brings to light a housing need. It actually puts a laser into this need. Of the 9 families that I've mentioned that were displaced by this fire, we know of 1 family that returned to their home country. We have 2 families that have moved out of town. We have 2 that have purchased trailers through some very generous support of some people in the community. Recently, we hired a community development director to come work in our community. He couldn't find a place to live. He's living in Avon now. So simply, there's a need for housing in greater Minnesota, and Melrose would be an excellent candidate to fill this need and through this particular tool. And we'd still try to apply for these other workforce housing grants as they become available to make it possible. But again, with limited resources, this would be a tool that we would be able to leverage without impacting the state's revenue sources there. So again, I thank you for the time and thank you for listening to my story of Melrose.
Thank you, Mr. Bedhorst. And Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this is for Representative Anderson. I guess the question I have is why limit it to just outstate or non-metro Minnesota? Because I hear the same desire and same complaints from people that they can't find affordable housing, workforce housing in the metro area also. I mean, it's not just there. I mean, I know Representative Lunan has had issues with people, because this is down there, being able to get people that can afford to live down there to take the jobs down there, that there's a labor shortage there. So I guess that's my question, is why just limit it to non-metro and not allow the metro area to also benefit from this, because
I think statewide this is an issue, not just in the outstate area.
Representative Anderson. I think that's a very good point, Representative Nelson, and one that I can't answer right now. I know the cost of building outstate when you build it and then what the assessed value is after they finish. There may be a wider variation outstate than here in the metro because the values hold better here. But certainly would look at that, and if you'd have any comments, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Heather Corcoran with the League.
Ms. Corcoran.
To Representative Nelson's question, I think there's also the issue of the depressed rents in greater Minnesota that contribute to that appraisal gap and the difficulty for comparable properties to be built to help with the appraisal gap when that is demonstrated. But I think we'd be interested in talking further if that's an issue in beyond greater Minnesota.
Representative Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess, again, in another committee we heard last week from builders that, and this was in the metro area, that they can't afford to buy. They can't build houses that are considered workforce housing that people can afford to buy because of different costs. So, like I said, I would look forward to, you know, this. It's a good program. I support it. It's a good idea. But to exclude the metro area, I think, is short-sighted because there are some of these same issues that are here as are in the outstate area with workforce housing.
Thank you. And Chair Drazkowski has a question.
Mr. Chair, I don't know who the question is for, but in structuring the bill, you know, one of the problems with TIF is that in the future, other property taxpayers are going to have to continue to shoulder a burden that is not being contributed to by those areas and those properties. And I appreciate the thresholds that are put in the bill, although the one about a business with 20 employees signing a letter saying that they'd like you to build a workforce housing with TIF is not real meaningful. Of course, a business will say that. But what about the people paying the additional tax burden in the future? Have you thought about maybe putting a referendum on there to and maybe this is for Representative Anderson, I don't know, a referendum or something like we do for local option sales tax to really get the commitment from the community that they want to do this.
Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Chair Drazkowski, I agree with what you're saying, except I would wonder that before the TIP district goes into effect, there was no tax, additional tax, because these houses were not there. So when you use a district and build additional housing, you can say you're losing tax revenue, but you're losing revenue that you never had in the first place. So I guess I would argue that it's not really a loss of revenue. The revenue that would have been gained by the taxes is going to a different source to be used to help pay down these costs. But I don't think it's an actual shift to other taxpayers in the district because they weren't collecting that revenue before the district, is my understanding.
About four-tenths. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think we're embarking on an area that's been discussed over and over again. But the other part of that is that there's additional services in there required, too, for those additional people and so forth, and those often don't get included in these discussions. Thank you.
I agree. Yeah.
Thank you. And Representative Loeffler has a question.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm still a little rusty on all the levels of improvement on TIF districts, and I'm wondering, do school districts and counties have to approve the a housing TIF district before it goes into effect, or is there an advice and consultation in that process? People of our staff can answer that.
I know that the counties get dragged along on that situation, but Mr. Michael, maybe you want to clarify that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, all types of tax increment districts are treated the same in terms of the overlapping units of government's approval authority. So it's only the city or the municipality that has to approve. The school and the county does not approve any type of TIF district, but they're allowed, the city is required to solicit their comments, and that's the extent of their involvement.
And Mr. Michael, I think if there's an extension of a TIF, then the school district has the authority to say yes or no. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, yes, if there's a special law that allows them to extend the general law duration, then it requires approval of that special law by both the county and the school.
Thank you for that clarification. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think that's something we have to wrestle with because, you know, you're adding new housing with people being paid wages that aren't able to support the rents that, that the market would need. Those probably are the same people who might be dependent on sliding fee child care or other supports, and some parts of rural Minnesota would really welcome some additional children. For others, it would be an additional cost and maybe strain their physical capacity. And so, you know, this does take the growth and that tax base from those other partners. The other thing that I'm concerned about is whether or not, in moving forward on this, we know there's an affordable housing shortage throughout the state at all income levels, at all, whether you're a worker or a middle-income worker or a lower-income worker, it's really hard right now in certain parts of the state to find housing. And it seems to me that, you know, an inability to find housing within a reasonable commuting distance might have to be proved or set some standard, as opposed to just the city wants people to live within their city city limits, and they might actually have plenty of housing in the next town down the road or the next township. And it seems to me that that might be a reasonable criteria so that it isn't that it is truly where there is a lack of housing within a reasonable commuting distance. Or some other standards so that we limit this before we just kind of open it up totally.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Anderson?
Just a comment that this program would be market rate housing. I think it was stated that it might not be, but this would be market rate housing.
Okay. Anyone else from the audience that would like to testify on this? So with that, Representative Anderson, any closing remarks?
No, thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for hearing the bill and hopefully see it included in this year's tax bill, much like last year's house tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Representative Anderson renews his motion for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Next, we'll take up House File 200, which will be Representative Means' bill. And Representative Loeffler moves House. He wants to do his own? All right. Mr. Lean, Representative Lean, I'm sorry, will move his bill, House File 200.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate you giving this bill and this issue some time and attention here today. House File 200, it's a bill that I put together after meeting with several farmers, Clay County farmers, over the last 3 years. And it's a legislative response to the current situation with the ag economy. For about the last 5 years, the ag economy has seen slumping crop prices. Now, despite these low crop prices, many farmers are struggling to pay with property taxes as property values remain high. House File 200 would establish a study to look at moving from Minnesota's current market-based valuation assessment system of ag land to an assessment system based on productivity of ag land. The study would be conducted by the Departments of Ag and Revenue in consultation with groups representing agriculture property owners, assessors, and University of Minnesota College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resource Sciences. The bill directs the study to focus on 11 areas related to ag property taxes that have been identified by landowners representing ag groups and the U of M College of Food, Ag, and Natural Resources. Some of these groups are availability and accuracy of data on ag land, potential shifts on other types of properties and other classes of property, valuation volatility under a production-based assessment system, assessment appeals by landowners, and how a production-based system would interact with existing property tax programs. The bill would appropriate $100,000 for the study and direct the study to be completed by February 1st, 2019, with a report to the House and Senate Tax Committees. To my knowledge, the last time a study like this was conducted was 1991, and I feel an updated study is required in order to fully analyze the situation, and if we can move to this production or this production-based assessment system, how it would work for Minnesota, how it would work efficiently, and how it would work effectively in regards to farmers and the ag community. Also, Mr. Chair, I do want to add that, as I mentioned, I have been working with several Clay County farmers over the last couple of years on this bill, on this concept, and they would have very much liked to have been here today just to tell their stories. However, they were not able to, and so, just to echo their support for the bill. And I believe the Farm Bureau and Farm Union would like to make comments on the bill.
Okay, thank you, Representative Lee. And Representative Barr, is your question to the author?
Yes.
Thank you, Representative Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, you referenced a study in 1991. Could you tell us a little bit about what the results of that study were?
Representative Lean.
Let's see here. They brought up some challenges, that this sort of a system would come to, and that was largely around upheals of assessments, the interaction of state aids, wetland and conservation easements, so some of those other sorts of, ag or non-homestead property programs, and then shifts, looking at in times of low crop prices, how is that going to impact other types of properties. And so it really just kind of laid out some of the challenges, that this sort of a system would look at. And so, like I say, I feel it's important to take another look at this to kind of refresh some of the data, refresh some of the concepts, but then also to have other stakeholders, ag landowners, as well as the assessors at the table talking about this issue.
Thank you, Representative Lean. And we have some testifiers on this. And welcome to the committee. If you'd state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we too do support House File 200. I believe we've supported the last couple of years that this bill has been around. We really appreciate a lot of the legislators' support for the ag credit. We've had that as it applies to school capital improvement levies. I'm talking about that and the impact that has on ag land, but the fact of the matter is ag property taxes have just risen. I forget what the number is. Maybe you mentioned it in the last 10 years, quite a bit. And a lot of that obviously has to do with the values and when commodity prices go high. And I think that's what frustrates farmers is the property tax system that we have reacts slowly to the price mechanism. So I think everybody understands, commodity prices go up, ag land values go up, property taxes go up, prices go down, and values on your property taxes, they take a while to go back down. And so right now we're in a very low commodity price, for example, with corn, soybeans, wheat, and property taxes are still very high. So a lot of farmers aren't going to have any money this year to make any money, but they're going to be stuck paying a very high property tax bill. And that's where a lot of the value is in their property. So we've always thought that it's worth looking at this. And you've seen other states, I believe South Dakota, Illinois, try to do some kind of variation of this piece. I also am not always a big fan of study groups. I've said this before because a lot of times I end up on them. But I think they're important because in this case, we did something with Green Acres a few years ago for some of the legislators, and that doing something like this would be a really big ship to turn. And we'd want to be really obviously careful in looking at how it, and the committee knows this, you raise it here and lowers it here and so on and so forth. We also have kind of looked at this issue a little bit besides the 1991 study. We had the property tax working group, and I forget what year it was on. I was on that, and we looked at the classifications and all of that, but we did look at the valuations and how that was somewhat. And then after that, we did have kind of an ad hoc group that we worked with the Department of Revenue, and I think we only had two meetings. We had Steve Taft from the University of Minnesota was really good on looking at values, and we just decided not to go forward at that point. But those are just some comments. I appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. The next testifier.
Mr. Chair and Committee, my name is Cole Rubrecht with Minnesota Farm Bureau Associate, our Federation. I'll just echo what Mr. Peterson said. We're very supportive of this study to look into evaluation based off of productivity. We've been very supportive through the last sessions as you guys have looked at the 40% credit as it goes towards school debt bonding, but we still need to look at the fact that in agriculture, farmers will still be paying six times as much, even with the credit, as what other people are paying as far as property tax. as Mr. Peterson alluded, with high market values on property right now in agricultural world and low commodity prices, this is a very tough time for farmers to pay their property taxes. So we want to thank Representative Lean for bringing this bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Rupert. And as the other testifiers get ready to come forward, Representative Barr has a question.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably not so much as a question as the testifier referenced some other states doing this kind of evaluation. I'm just wondering, it doesn't have to be right now, but if the committee could get some additional information on what those other states are doing so that we could take a look at that.
Thank you, Representative Barr. Any other questions from members? Okay, next testifier, please. Welcome back, Mr. May.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Tom May for the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. We certainly don't oppose any kind of study that looks at our property tax system and tries to make it better. With that said, as far as production values, we've been there, we've done that over the years, and it's been referred to as a study. And Department of Revenue did that study working with ag economists from the Minnesota University of Minnesota. Also, I guess if you really get down and look at it, it adds some complexity. I would tell you that the state of Nebraska is looking at this issue right now, and I know in the Ag Committee I did send a copy of that news article, and they're finding so far that they can convert to that. It adds a lot of complexity, but it doesn't necessarily make a big impact on the bottom line of results. So if it would be okay, I would like to send that article from Nebraska to the committee so that they can take a look at that and see what they're finding there.
Thank you, Mr. May. And Mr. May, I mean, there's three ways we generally value property in Minnesota. It's the cost approach, market approach, and income approach. This production mode is really an income approach. Would you envision something coming forward that would really truly quantify each of these different approaches to come up with a hybridized value?
Well, of course, at this point, for agriculture, we use the market approach predominantly. But the income approach, it could be used with the different things that add the complexity, like you say, with yields and all this. But the cap rates that drive that still come out of the market, right, like any other approach. So we still have that market influence that would carry through that approach as we go through it. But, our Ag Committee from MAO, that are the ag experts, and certainly I'm not, say that the added complexity, they're not sure it would make a large difference in the results.
Thank you. Mr. Cummins, do you have a comment?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We just wanted to say that we would like to continue the conversation throughout the session if this is a priority of this committee. We know that this is for one select industry, and, you know, whether you're a homeowner or your business or whether you're a farmer, you're paying the property tax whether you're having a good year or a bad year. So, you know, this is for one certain industry, and, you know, there are other types of out there. Wanted to also say that there were recommendations related to ag property taxation in the 2012 report that came out for the property tax working group, and I know that they may be something to consider. We would want to make sure that something that is brought back to this committee is useful, and if we bring people together to do reports and then that isn't useful to the committee, I just want to make sure we're providing something that is useful. We also want to make sure that the right questions are asked and the right people are designated in the report in case that comes up. We obviously have an interest in ensuring that the property tax system works well for Minnesota. That's part of the role that the Department of Revenue has. So, you know, we share that interest with all of our taxpayers, and we look forward to continuing to be a resource on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cummins. And Representative Joaquin has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, it's more of a comment to Representative Lean. I just want to thank you for bringing forward the bill. I like the approach of taking a study it looks like you're bringing in a lot of the stakeholders to make sure that the information is going to be useful. So I just wanted to lend my support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other members from the audience? Representative Anderson has a question.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. More of a comment, I guess. This is an important topic right now as farmers face this squeeze on profits or lack of profits. And it's difficult how to put a value on the farmland. And the one thing we talked about in the Ag Committee is that, at least with farmland, there is a certain, I think, part of that value that's caused by speculation, whether it doesn't come up more than once in a lifetime or somebody in Chicago thinks that land prices are going to continue going up. There's that speculative piece to land prices. And farmers are frustrated because they can't use that speculative piece of the price of land until they decide to sell it again. So if there was some way, I know we've tried limited market value before, which assessors didn't like that approach either, but some way to take that speculative value off the price of farmland to get to a more realistic or productive type level, to me would make a lot of sense if we could somehow work towards that.
Thank you. And again, anyone else from the audience that would like to testify on this bill? Seeing none, any questions yet from members? Closing remarks, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Again, I really appreciate your attention on this issue overall and with this bill. And Representative Barr, I do have some information here, and for committee staff too. It's a packet on how different land ag lands are assessed in different states, and it's from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy and George Washington Institute of Land Policy. And this was put together, or at least this is dated December 2014, so it might be some information there we can use. But again, thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative. And Representative Lean renews his motion to move House File 200 for possible inclusion into an omnibus bill. And last but not least, Chair Daskowski has House File 465. And Chair Daskowski moves his House File 465 for possible inclusion. And to your bill, Chair Daskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 465 is a bill that was passed as part of the 2015 House Omnibus Tax Bill, House File 848. And I'll walk through the bill quickly, but essentially Section 1 provides that no state monies will be used to or be spent for a zip rail or a inter-regional passenger rail facility between the Twin Cities and Rochester. Section 2 provides that there will be, if there's a private development developing such a proposal, that there will be a security bond set aside that if and when it fails, that money be used to put the state's resources back together again. Section 3 provides that no eminent domain authority, state eminent domain authority, will be used to build such a facility. Section 4 provides that an environmental insurance policy needs to be brought forward by any company or entity looking to build such a project so that if there's environmental damage, that is covered. Section 5 provides no local spending from local governments. And, Mr. Chair, that's why it's mostly before the committee here, is because it relates to local government finance and spending. And Section 6, Mr. Chair, focuses on Met Council spending and its inability to spend money on a zip rail or interregional passenger rail facility. With us, we have Nora Felton, who would like to testify on the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair Daskowski, and would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Nora Felton. I am a farmer in both Dakota and Goodhue County. I am co-founder of Seacarl. I own part of the Great Western Industrial Park in Randolph, and I used to be a representative for Green Giant, so I understand some of the important issues of the vegetable processing and seed corn production in this particular special area. And I want to thank you for inviting me to come speak today. I am again here to say that HF 465 is absolutely necessary to protect the taxpayer and to get some control over our passenger rail department at the Minnesota Department of Transportation. At the last hearing, somebody asked, why is this still needed? I understand that this project has been shelved, and I would ask you to look at the handouts that I've included, mainly the governor's capital request proposal that came out in January, which was distributed at the High Speed Rail Commission in Red Wing, that specifically has zip rail listed in the last line of the boxed area. Please also note that in the other requests for funding proposals that are in there, we've highlighted in gray how these funding requests would be used, and that it would include anything that's in the state rail plan of 2015, which we provided testimony for. But like a lot of testimony, they took it, they logged it, and didn't pay any attention to it, and put the zip rail into the state plan anyway. Please also notice the article that was published 7 months after the rail study was supposed to be shelved. It has direct quotes from the head of the passenger rail department, Dan Crom, stating that, indeed, this rail study is continuing. And lastly, there is the FNC article that talks about all of the transportation projects that they want to have done in the Twin Cities. This came out, I believe, January 3rd, and it lists, lastly, the Twin Cities high-speed rail project. This gives you a glimpse of how the passenger rail department and the passenger rail forum, who you folks put in charge of having the duty and the mission of vetting and prioritizing rail projects, has gotten out of control. This group of cheerleaders has decided that every rail project known to man should be included in the state plan or get some funding at some point. Their latest project, the Dan Patch. Keep in mind that not only have they not vetted or prioritized projects that they keep throwing money at, but they indeed had to go to the Ramsey County Rail Authority and borrow $600,000 because they hadn't kept enough money aside to take on what's supposed to be their first priority of high-speed rail, which is the river route. You can check that out. That's in their minutes as well. Keep in mind that the head of the department, Dan Crom, when asked about why the passenger rail department and passenger rail forum was not doing their duty, he said to me, well, it's like choosing which one of your children you're not going to feed. I would suggest that the legislator should take back their authority and be the adults in the room and help them do some family planning of rail projects. Because I guarantee, as long as Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith, who is head of the DMC, the Destination Medical Center, which I believe is somewhat of a conflict of interest, as long as she's in charge of the DMC and the DMC wants zip rail, that any dollar that's left falling on the floor of the passenger rail department will go towards what we call the zombie zip rail. Thank you.
Thank you. And any questions from members?
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment to an author's amendment.
I'm sorry. I didn't see that in the packet here.
No, I forgot to bring up. Is the bill moved, Mr. Chair?
You did move the bill.
Thank you. I would move, Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment, which provides that the reference to this rail line be taken out of the state rail plan, which it is in the 2015 state rail plan.
Okay. All those in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed?
No.
And the motion is adopted. And no one other? Oh, there is a gentleman from the audience would like to testify. If you would state your name for the record, please, sir, and continue.
My name is Jay Severance. I am representing the All Aboard Minnesota organization, which is a 501c3 organization that promotes intercity rail passenger transportation, particularly in Minnesota and throughout the region. I submitted last night, didn't know that this was going to be on the agenda today, but last night I submitted a comment regarding this bill. I can't speak to some of the things that she's talking about. What I'm talking about is what's physically in this bill, the intent of the rail program, et cetera. I don't see as being part of this. But at any rate, what I'll do is paraphrase this. I sent it to all of the members of the committee, and I'll give you a copy of, in case you don't have one.
Mr. Severance, we have 3 minutes left, so if you could be brief.
Okay, fine. I'll just paraphrase. First of all, we are in opposition to this proposal. On behalf of the members, we urge you to turn it down. The provision of the bill as written would essentially prohibit all public funding for any passenger rail project which would link Rochester in its metro area to the Twin Cities metro area. While this appears to target the Zip Rail project, and it's very obvious that that's what it is, and it's a proposed corridor, the wording would also preclude any public funding for rail projects using existing rail or rights of way linking Rochester and the Twin Cities. The Minnesota Passenger Rail Plan includes a project to reestablish rail links to southern Minnesota and onward to Des Moines and Kansas City. Rochester is one of the cities that would be considered for service under that plan. Because Rochester is the third largest city in the state and the site of the Destination Medical Center, it's inconceivable that the Rochester metro area could be isolated from being considered for rail transportation. Further, this bill would limit access from the Twin Cities to the Destination Medical Center for many people, such as myself, that are elderly and don't drive that well. At this stage of development, I think it's inappropriate to limit public consideration of passenger rail options between Rochester and the Twin Cities. While the Board of Minnesota does not take a particular position on the specific merits of the Zip Rail project, however, we do support, as is being done in other states, public-private consortiums, which this Zip Rail would be. Again, we don't necessarily support it. In essence, we're asking that this not be sent forward.
Thank you, Mr. Severance. And Representative Lou King has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Druskowski, I was just reading through that A2 amendment again, and on line 1.13 and 1.14, it seems like it makes a pretty substantial change of adding or references, kind of like the prohibition on the other line that shall not be named. I'm still trying to learn the jurisdiction of Transportation and Regional Governance Policy Committee and this committee just and how they interact. With this substantial change, shouldn't it go back to Transpo to discuss this?
Chair Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Joaquin, this was an oversight. As we came out of that committee, it was intended. We discussed the fact that it was in the rail plan, and so we're bringing it for this committee here. It could be offered on the floor as well. But anyway, we're here before the committee. And
Representative Ewing. Okay, thank you. And it looks like we have one more testifier, if you would, please. And if you would state your name for the committee, please.
Dr. Heidi Edmondson, and I'm a PhD doctor, not an MD doctor. Thank you for taking the time. Chair, members of the committee, I am here speaking on behalf of myself as someone who lives in the Twin Cities and works in Rochester, as well as a family member of patients who have received specialty care at Mayo Clinic.
Ms. Edmondson, did you say Edmondson?
Yes,
Edmondson. Thank you.
I lived and worked in Rochester for 17 years, and in 2013 I got married, and due to his shared custody situation, my husband could not move his children from the Bloomington school system. While we were investigating logistics for bringing our household together, in 2012 we learned that there was a commuter bus that took off from Mall of America going to Rochester. And at that time there were two commuter buses every morning. In 2013 that had grown to three commuter buses leaving from Mall of America. And now there are five commuter buses going down there every morning. So I just wanted to give you an idea of the rapid growth of people who are finding employment in Rochester and for various reasons are using those commuter options. It's about an hour and 45-minute ride one way. Switching over to the specialty care, Mayo Clinic provides specialty care that oftentimes is not available anywhere else in the world and sometimes only in a few places within the country. I want to give an example of my mother who went down there for simple foot surgery and in the process of a single morning was diagnosed with a rare genetic disorder. And that diagnosis answered questions that she had had her entire life, that her mother had had, and her grandmother before that. It also informs the care of my siblings and nieces and nephews because with that disorder, they need to have annual cardiac checkups because something that can happen with it is that there can be arrhythmias that cause sudden death. There are many different treatment regimens that take a significant amount of time, such as radiation therapy. Oftentimes the treatment regimen for that is daily treatments over the course of a month. My mother-in-law went down to Mayo to have radiation treatment, and she couldn't drive herself. Her husband needed to work during that time, and so she stayed at the American Cancer Society Hope Lodge. And there was a waiting list for that because there are many people from the Twin Cities needing to go down there for long treatment regimens. So as a new resident of the Twin Cities, most often when I introduce myself, people say to me that, oh, my mother went there, my father went there, or my sister or brother went there as a last course of action after they had exhausted all of their treatment options up in the Twin Cities. And so I'm often left wondering, if we made it easier to get to Rochester, how many lives would be changed, significantly changed, if they had an option to go to Mayo Clinic as a first option as opposed to a last resort? So thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Edmondson. Any other questions? With that concluding remarks, Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really nothing more. We had in-depth discussion about the high capital cost of this proposal and the ongoing perpetual liability that it would cast upon Minnesota. But really the focus in this committee is about the cost potentially to local governments and in our realm of local government finance. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Representative Nelson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I mentioned in an earlier bill, checked into whether I need to go to GovOz because of the language, and I wasn't sure whether that one did. And but this one here, we're basically stripping away local authority from local governments. And Mr. Chair, is this intent to bring this bill to local government operations to look at that piece?
Representative Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, no. We have the jurisdiction of local government finance, and that's why it's before the committee today.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And with that, any other questions? The Chair Draskowski renews his motion to lay over House File 465 for possible inclusion. And members, thank you for your indulgence in extra meeting and running over a little bit. And as we get close to committee deadlines, I think this is a regular occurrence. With that, the meeting is adjourned.